Our guest now grew up in Hawke's Bay and has drawn on his childhood and upbringing to shape his writing. After a career in property and hospitality, Mark Sweet is now writing full-time. His titles include Portrait and Opinion and Wine, Stories from Hawke's Bay. His new novel, The History Speech, is set in 1960s provincial New Zealand. In it, he examines some of the era's repression, negative undercurrents and behaviour that broke convention. Even a bit of wife swapping in Hastings. The story is told through the eyes of a 12-year-old boy, and it reflects some of what Mark Sweet was aware of as a young boy growing up in Hawke's Bay. Mark is with us. Thank you so much. Welcome.
Ah, Morena, thank you.
It's a lovely novel, and I'm really... Is it the first novel for you? You've written before, Mark, but is this the first novel for?
No, I wrote a novel called Zoomow, 7 years ago, which was on Radio New Zealand, serialised, read by Georges Henery very well. Yeah.
Wonderful. Because this has the touch of an experienced fiction writer, and I'm really curious about the transitions you've made in life before we come to the story, into non-fiction genre and then into a novel of this calibre. Were you always writing, even as you moved through these other very busy professional careers?
Yeah, I sort of dabbled with short stories, poetry as a younger man, but not seriously until I sort of turned 50 and had an epiphany that if I didn't sort of fulfill my ambition to write more seriously, I'd end up a bitter and twisted old man. So I made the transition from restauranteuring to writing full-time. Yeah, with the assistance of the Te Papatupu program, which was a huge assistance for me in writing my first novel, Zoomow.
How so? How so? How did that work?
Oh, it was a 6-month mentored program. So, and we were, you know, paid a reasonable amount of money to work really full time on our novels, and I was teamed up with an editor writer by the name of Alia Bloom, and she helped me shape the novel Zoomow really well, and it was published a year later. Mm.
The History Speech, you are open in an epilogue about the influences and the real life characters and the fictional characters and whom influenced whom. Had this been brewing in you, this story, however it was to unfold? Is it a setting in a time and a place that had been brewing for a long time?
No, I don't think it had been brewing for a long time. There were a couple of triggers that sort of set me off on the path. One of them was that I discovered or found out that Ulysses, the movie, was censored to segregated audiences in 1967. So it was regarded as, men and women needed to be separated to watch this movie, because I think they used the F word a couple of times, and there was a scene of a man in bed with two women, naked. So the idea of, and then I attended a tangi, a funeral of an old friend, and at that tangi was an old gentleman who I knew had been part of the sort of the fast set in Hawke's Bay during the 50s, 60s, 70s. And the conversation got to wife swapping, and he was in his 90s, and he was able to tell me how you structured wife swapping. That wasn't part of my parents' experience, because I did ask my parents, but they didn't know much about it, but this old guy did. And so those two were the triggers. And that idea of public morality and then private behaviour really fascinated me, you know, the secrets people keep and different levels of secrets. Yeah, so that's really how it started.
Our protagonist is 12-year-old Callum, and again, is this where we do get that mix of memory and experience of the times as well as the fictionalising?
Well, I really wanted to set it in Hawke's Bay because that's what I knew really well. And so many of the places are a fact, and then others are fiction. As with people, I made the decision, and I thought it was a bit risky, to populate the novel with characters who were living in those times. So at TMV Vineyards, which became Tamata Estate when John Buck bought it, or reverted back to Tamata Estate, my mother and I would go there to get the flagons of sherry, and Mr. Toogood would be the man who helped us. And then we'd go to the mushroom farm, and Mr. Speeden would be the man who would assist us. And so I decided to use these characters, these real people, in my novel. They don't take any part in the action, but I just thought, we populate novels with real places. I'll populate it with real people as well. And, so by choosing real places, it meant that I was able to describe them really well. I mean, there's a scene in the book at Westerman's department store, and many older people will remember that we used to pay in cash, and it used to go into a sort of vacuum tube that would race across the ceiling and then get filled out with the invoice, and it would come back like a snake to the desk where the change would be given. Things like that. I just wanted to recapture those days.
It's so evocative. I remember that at the DIC in Dunedin. And you mentioned flagons of sherry. I think they were called Peters of sherry down there. So it's a lovely way, isn't it, of being able to reminisce and actually evoke a time and a place that some people will actively remember, and for others it can help paint a scene. Who is Callum, and what is happening in his life?
Well, Callum's a sensitive young boy. He loves reading. He loves history. And he's really caught between his great loyalty to his grandfather, and he struggles with his father. His father is a bully, really, very ambitious. And his mother develops through the story. Callum... When I was writing this novel, I was very aware of Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey, which is, it's a model for writing a novel. So Callum is the hero, and he is faced with adversity and decisions and challenges, and he steps up and takes on the world, really. He's a brave boy, Callum, and... is well rewarded for it in the end. Yeah.
Again, we revisit the times through some fairly obvious ways to sort of test them, I guess. And the schooling era is particularly well portrayed. Again, for those who would have gone through traditional schooling, New Zealand schooling in the 1960s, they would recognise some of the characters and the behaviours here, for better and worse.
Yeah. I chose to set the school as a real school. In the beginning, I didn't. I called it another name. But in the end, I decided, well, why not call it by its name? And it was Harroworth Preparatory School for Boys in Havelock North. And when I attended, they gave you a classic education. We learned French and Latin and history. And there was a teacher. We called them masters, who would start every lesson with reading the Dominion. He was a fantastic teacher. And old Billy is sort of based on him and another teacher, my Latin teacher. But this man would, his name was Hank Grant, great teacher, and Sidney Grant. And that's how he'd start the day. And people who read the book will probably, I've had friends ring me who went to school with me at Harroworth and recognise and enjoyed the book immensely, but he was obsessed with the Vietnam War. So we had a lot of discussion about the Vietnam War.
There's the good, there's the heroes who say, hands off that boy, he's the brightest student I've had. I won't go into too many details, but let's just set the scene. And then there's the inevitable person who can't wait to get their hands on the cane. And as with any good story, I think, about with children as protagonists, there's often a lack of judgment about what they go through. I remember this reading Angela's Ashes. It struck me that as an adult reading it, I was mortified by everything I was reading. But for the young protagonist, it's just life. And I think you capture that. We know the injustice, but the way a young person experiences and rationalises their world can be different.
Well, of course, this is normal. These schools are quite brutal, you know. Teachers beat boys and beat them till they bled. It was not happy times. And I don't want to go into it too much, but Māori boys at Harroworth were picked upon by certain masters. Yeah, and that was the truth.
The home life is the lens through which you also capture the mood of the times. And as you say, there's this repressed morality, but then what happens behind closed doors is a different matter. But also the parental relationship there. And it is, again, it's what Callum is navigating. And again, without an overt judgment, I mean, he clearly knows what's going on with respect to his home life and also, as you say, his relationship with the grandfather and the friction and the standoff that runs through the plot of the book. But again, he rises above it.
Yeah, well, he's a hero. He is challenged with adversity and he has decisions to make, either to, you know, to fight or flight, and he decides to fight. His relationship with his father, of course, is really fraught. But in the book, it's explained that Callum's father, John, didn't have a father himself, or a father who didn't father him. So actually, Callum's father doesn't know how to be a father. And sort of somehow Callum understands that because he gets the fatherly support from his grandfather, and then he meets people and sort of nurtures people who are supportive of him. The Miss Billingtons, for instance, are a great couple. And their sort of position in the novel is that they are part of the Steiner movement, the Theosophical movement, which was very strong in Havelock North during the 20s and 30s, and they worship at Foro Ra, which is the Temple of the Golden Dawn, which is a real place and exists.
His primary friendships, and again, without wanting to give too much away of how things unfold, who are the friends who are pivotal to Callum and the person he's becoming?
Well, his grandfather is a pivotal friend, but then he's distanced. The book starts off with sort of a bit of graffiti that Callum marks on the pavement, sort of demonstrating his affection for his friend Michael Madden, but he discovers through the book that Michael isn't a particularly good friend. I think the strongest characters are the Miss Bannisters, who are the Theosophical couple. And his mother. His mother rises to the occasion in the end. She's very defensive in the beginning, but the more she sees, the more she supports Callum, especially in the accusation of sexual abuse. Perpetrated against his friend Angie. So that's a very important part of the book. Yeah.
You pursue as a theme in the book those hidden abuses, and they are hidden abuses in many cultures and many times. You did not want to shy away from them, whether it was racism, sexism, sexual abuse and homophobia. But it's not a polemic. It is just what we come to see through the experiences of the characters in the book, but definitely a theme that you wanted out there and explored.
Yeah. In a way, I normalised really bad behaviour because that's what happened. I mean, yeah, an unpleasant part of this book and of the reality is that parents left their children unsafe when they partied. So there were these dinner parties where the kids were taken along and put into bedrooms. There's a lot of alcohol consumed, and the kids weren't safe. And that's a fact. And I treat that in the book, I think, quite subtly. But, you know, the reader is very aware that there's this undercurrent of abuse. Yeah. It's tricky. Yeah.
It is, but it is very, very well done, Mark. And the other theme also is the power that some men would wield in particular. But you did not set all your male characters in that frame of being aggressive or domineering or controlling. And was it important to do that?
I knew I needed some balance. I do confess, I really wanted to take a whack at the patriarchy, the elitist, entitled men who think they can control everything, including their children and wives. But of course, we had to have a balance with other male characters who are sympathetic, hence Mr. Billington. But it's mostly the female characters that I deliberately decided to make the strong people. Mm.
Your own memories of this time, and it's complicated because growing up, coming of age, anywhere, any time and place, carries its complications. But when you reflect on your own time and place for growing up, do you do so positively? Do you do so now looking back and seeing it, how much was unfair or how much was wrong?
Well, I had a really privileged upbringing. So I was well educated. I came from a household that was loving and supportive, mostly. But, you know, when I think back on my adolescence and childhood, it's through a sort of a veil of the adulthood now. I'm very interested in the subjects of loss of innocence. And for any child, it is a pathway, a journey from innocence to learning what the world's about through, you know, stuff happens. But to answer your question, I don't know if as a child I was aware of injustice. I think I was just pretty normal, pretty selfish, pretty self-absorbed, and was pretty much me, me, me.
The character of the grandfather here, did you have someone particularly in mind, your own or someone else's, in writing this character?
Well, my paternal grandfather, Redmond Sweet, was a sergeant during the First World War, and he was a logistics. He was in logistics. He stayed on 2 years after armistice to disband in the Horse Brigade. Thousands of horses went from New Zealand to the front. Grandad had a picture of a man on his desk, and on one occasion, I asked who he was. And the look, expression on my grandfather's face was so grim, I knew never to ask again. So that theme in the book where Callum hears his grandfather talking to the photograph does come from my own experience. But the person I made that photograph, Ralph Gibson, is, of course, is fiction. And the story of Ralph Gibson unfolds during the book. In fact, it's the history speech. Because he perished in the First World War, and Callum wants to know how he died. Callum is fascinated by death. He's at that age, 12, 13 years old, where I think a lot of kids first realise that death is real it happens. Have I drifted a bit off the question here?
No, it's a happy drifting. It's a happy drifting indeed.
Okay.
Your the transition again into writing. I love what you said when you said at 50. If I don't do it now, I'll never forgive myself. But
yeah. It's,
you know, these careers, demanding careers, property sector and restaurants, Pacifica and Napier. Is that wonderful restaurant on Marine Parade? In the house on Marine Parade.
Yes.
There you go. I've dined there.
I've...
going back 20 plus years.
Oh, great. Well, I owned it between. I bought the old building and refurbed it, and then ran it for 7 years, from 2000 to 2008. And then, and before that, I had a restaurant in Glasgow, which was the same thing. I bought a burnt out burger bar and created a 30 seat restaurant at 88 Dumbarton Road, which I called Two Fat Ladies after the bingo call. It's still going too. Yeah.
It's a massive shift in lifestyle from one that is based on, people around all the time and a buzz and a service, an immediate service to a lot of people and all that entails, to the solitude of writing. Was it a relief in some ways, that transition? A different way of being?
It certainly is a different way of being. I still miss and am nostalgic for the sort of the whānau aspect of running a restaurant, because, you know, people are dependent upon you and they become very much part of one's life, and it's a daily ongoing relationship. I really miss that part of it. It's great. But I was fortunate, you know, I was in Glasgow during the 80s, 90s, so... You know, we used to go and listen to Simple Minds playing in the pub. And it was that whole dance era. So, and I was young. It was great. Yeah. And the transition, yeah, it is. But I think as you get older, you become more, like, resilient. And with writing fiction especially, I create a world of characters who inhabit my life massively. I mean, I tell people that these people grow and then they live, and some of them, you know, insist on having a say in the story, even. It sounds a bit crazy, but that's how it works for me. Yeah.
No, it's back to Elizabeth Strout from 2 or 3 weeks ago, and Olive Kitteridge literally appeared behind her while she's doing the dishes, I think, and said something.
Yeah.
These characters do live with people. Are you working on a very different... you know, what is happening now with new writing? Are you working on a different form or a completely different story? What's percolating now?
No, I'm actually sticking to the sort of the genre that I'm feeling comfortable with. So I'm working on a novel now that spans 30 years, from 1970 to the beginning of the millennium, 2000. It's a family drama, lots of content, set in Hawke's Bay, London, and Marseille. So I was going to go to Marseille in May to do some background research, but that'll have to wait.
That's what we call sweeping.
Yeah.
A sweeping novel. And the writing style...
Yeah,
go ahead. I was just going to say the writing style, Mark, like there is a... It's not... I wouldn't use the word sparse, but it's that classic... understated, isn't it? And I don't know how long it takes any writer to truly reach that level in their craft of saying enough but not too much, so that the reader is there experiencing it. Did you said you had the wonderful experience of the mentoring course. Did you fairly quickly find your voice and your style, or has it just had to be honed?
In the beginning, I was really verbose and wrote far too much, explained too much. I think it was Elspeth Sands who, she did a critique on Zuma at one stage, and she introduced me to the idea of show, don't tell, and less is more. But I must say, with the history speech, I had a fantastic editor, Daisy Coles, who she helped me trim a lot of excess out of the book. But most of all, what Daisy did for the history speech was encourage me, persuade me to change the ending. I had a very brutal ending. And Daisy introduced me to the idea that the writer goes into contract with the reader. And if a reader stays with you for 4 or 5 hours to read your book, and then you just give them something they never, ever expected, and this take a terrible ending, you're sort of breaking a contract with the reader. So she persuaded me to a happy ending, and I'm really, really glad I took her advice. Yeah, her and Bryony Walker from Huya Publishers. Yeah, they were great.
It's a beautiful novel, Mark. Thank you. All the best for the next one, which sounds like a massive project, and as you say, interrupted, I guess, the research at the moment. But there'll be plenty else to do in the forming of a novel on that scale.
Yeah.
Thanks for your time.
Well,
Mark
thank
Sweet.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Yeah.
Kia ora. You're welcome. The History Speech is by Mark Sweet and published by Huia.